Good morning. Welcome to our webinar on restructuring corporations with systemic risk for the financial system. We have Carlos Ortiz Cañabate and Igor Marzu from Argos Consulting, Argos Partners. They will share their long-time experience in these type of restructuring. We will have a brief Q&A session at the end of the presentation. Without further ado, I give the floor to Igor and Carlos. Thank you. I want to thank the ASPA team and namely Pascual for giving us the opportunity of joining you in this webinar. It's an honor to share our view and our experience in restructuring corporations with systemic risk for the financial system. I will try to be short, brief, and fun as possible, bearing in mind the sensitivity and the intensity of the topic. I want to thank all the participants for expressing their interest in this topic. Our presentation will last 45 to 50 minutes, and we will have a brief 10-minute Q&A to share with you. So please feel free to share any comments, any questions, remarks using the app's questions button. Thank you, Carlos. Good morning, everybody. My name is Igor Marzo from Argos Partners. Just like Carlos was saying, in today's session, we will explain the systemic risks posed on this financial sector from major corporations and the types of measures that can be taken to manage such intense situations in the COVID-19 era. Let's start with today's agenda. This will be a 45 to 50 minute presentation, and we reserved 10 to 15 minutes for a Q&A, or perhaps we can even elaborate even further if you should have more questions. First, we will identify the main systemic risks associated to corporations as to determine our context. Number two, we will identify with clarity the causes of restructuring needs. Sometimes there's confusion between the causes and the symptoms of a certain issue. Vis-a-vis the COVID-19 situation, for instance, you know that symptoms are fever, cough, respiratory distress, but those are the symptoms, not the causes. You have to address and mitigate the causes. My colleague, Carlos Ortiz, will delve into the details. Another key aspect is the scope of a restructuring process. Whenever you embark in such endeavor, you have to encompass the different phases. You have to check the scope and the levers within each company. Otherwise, you may start out a process without having a route map, without knowing where it will end, which is a great danger because you may leave the process incomplete or try to detour. And you know, detouring is not necessarily the best strategy to achieve successful results. The next aspect revolves around the coordination methods between debtors, creditors, and institutions. Whenever there's a debtor and a bank involved, we know what the situation is. But if we have strategic providers or third parties, that same communication process becomes more difficult. It becomes more complicated, and coordination is required. Finally, we will provide a conceptual explanation of the main refinancing strategies and the impact on provisions and financial entities impairment. Without further ado, let us start with the first part. The different systemic risks we may encounter. Let me start with the second risk on the right side of the screen, the risk of macroeconomic shocks. This is where we are currently at. Nobody had contemplated a pandemic. We've seen the stress upon governments. Governments did not have a pandemic on top of their priorities. And all over the world, you know, in scale one countries, we see a better reaction, but we do see a certain level of complexity among different countries. Smaller countries have been able to recover or are recovering better because it's easier, whereas larger economies are having a harder time because they're not as integrated. So there is a shock posed on the GDP, double digit figures losses all over the world. We've seen the quarterly reports, but we know that this may prevail throughout 2020 and recoveries may be seen in 2021 or up to 2023. Sudden drops in currency devaluations is yet another effect in emerging economies due to the uncertainty, hyperinflation as well. The macroeconomic shocks that end up taking a toll on the system. In addition, we need to talk about the risk of an imbalance. The 2008 crisis imposed the risk of imbalance upon the real estate sector and the financing sector, where major risks had been accrued with low capitalization on the bank side, and they were highly concentrated on certain sectors. When the real estate sector, when their real estate sector's growth started to slow down, we witnessed losses among different financial entities with an impact on the actual economy, which is certainly a different situation from the one we are experiencing. And the main risk right now among the larger corporations in the economy is the risk of contagion. Large corporations have a first risk, which is the risk of failed payments. They have clearly identified and quantified this. But the second risk is the risk of transmission towards the economy. There are sectors depending on larger corporations like the oil sector or other sectors like the electricity, the energy sector. So suppliers depend on a certain customer, and if that customer, that client is contaminated, they will stop payments and they in turn will not be able to pay their own debts. This will be the second wave upon financial entities. In addition to other risks, such as debts or loans granted to company employees, restructuring, sudden drops in employment as well. And this will all be reflected in the economy. If you've read economic news recently, you'll see that the US default rates for credit cards will be high. That is the expectation. So the risk of contagion exists. We started with large corporations with high unemployment rates, and it just permeates throughout the whole system. What mechanisms do entities have to manage the risks? Because entities, financial entities, are well designed to manage risks in a normal environment with 2 to 3% default rates and not 15 to 20% rates that we will see in months to come, and we will see that damage as well, and it will come very soon. In the right-hand chart, you will see the credit policies and regulations. And if we move on from the general to particular, when it comes to regulatory measures, there are maximum concentration policies upon one debtor. A bank cannot lend over 5% to their capital to a debtor to prevent that one default in one company may endanger the capital base, in addition to the multiple and varied methods. The underwriting criteria are also important. How are loans going to be granted? What types of leverage will allow to appreciate the value of the loan and the value of securities, and the types of sectors in which they're active? A certain group of sectors, depending on activities or bad experiences in the past, or if they're problematic sectors, we will not work with them. And finally, ad hoc credit policies by sector. Perhaps a financial sector works with a certain sector on a regular basis, but not with another because of a bad previous experience. This is the front line, the bank's front line of defense. This is how they have built their credit portfolio and how loans have been granted. The second line of defense is a little bit more passive. It includes the underwriting criteria. And the pre-COVID era was only 6 months ago, though it may seem longer. And we have higher levels, and there was solvency. We had managed to learn from the lessons given to us by the 2008 crisis, and banks are fortunately now more capitalized. This is the front line of defense in the depression or recession we're currently living in. There are other types of instruments. The financial derivatives on different portfolios. Now, this is the typical timeline of insolvency whenever there's systemic risk. In a normal company, due to a weak competitive position or whenever things are bad, there's a certain dynamic that may lead to default of payments. And there are other situations such as accounting fraud. To recover from a situation like this may take many years. Whenever there's a crisis, there's a negative spiral which damages the economy in the fast track, and they may collapse in just a few months. As benefits fall and as there start to appear cash flow issues, there's feedback among the negative aspects. The financial institutions are restricted in their actions. So planning declining profits and cash flows is the starting point. But the most important part comes afterward, and that's when value destruction starts. As Carlos was just saying, the first phase in normal conditions, as we call it in English, the timeline of distress or the value destruction process may take a few years. unless there's fraud or something else, it's not normal to have performing and non-performing companies changing their status in such a short period of time. We are currently talking about a situation where you may have a company that was under normal conditions, but within 3 to 4 or 2 to 6 months, maybe, they find themselves in default. So it is a pretty complicated situation. What we see here in the chart is that the event of default takes place when control passes from debtors to lenders to the financial institutes. This is what the law and the theory says, but in practical terms, financial creditors must act earlier, because if they wait for the default to happen, which Carlos will explain next, both the internal and external causes that led to the problem may have already been crystallized, or they're stronger now, and it's going to be difficult to bring the company back to the solvency and liquidity situation it had before. So we need to act quickly. In Colombia, the moratorium was 4 months, in Mexico, 4 months plus 2, and debtors could request a waiver, could file for a waiver without having to pay the main interest, without it posing a negative impact on provisions for financial entities. So certain debtors have now considered that it's like a free pass for 6 months, and that's the wrong approach. However, there are other sectors, such as the airline sector, they're taking measures immediately because they may have a 6 month accounting cushion. Liquidity and cash flow is demanding a way out, a restructuring in the best way possible, in order to get back to the situation of balance they had before. It is key to act in coordination. Financial entities and debtors should act in coordination. Perhaps debtors are not legally binded to collaborate, but financial institutions do have many arguments to impose a formal restructuring process. Otherwise, time will go by and we may have lost these accounts. After the event of default, there's credit acceleration and enforcement phases. This is the phase where restructuring should no longer happen, because this is where more value is destroyed. We lose control. There are new actors throughout the process. I don't want to criticize lawyers, but the process basically becomes a legal process other than a financial process. And the search for the financial optimum is no longer as important, because we're dealing with the legal process. These are judicial processes, and you need to think that in this current situation, we will have to deal with many insolvencies, collapsing the judicial system as well. And companies may end up dying, and not because they're not willing to reach an agreement, but when you go to the judge, since the judge has to file 8 other lawsuits, judges are human too. They're not capable of processing all that information so easily. So we will have to deal with bankruptcy, although we will have to prevent that from happening. There are 3 concepts here which are highly important in a restructuring process. First, the steering committee. We will explain how the restructuring processes must be coordinated, including the main financial creditors and the debtor. It is advisable that institutions stress this process, the declining profits and cash flows or the default, and perhaps require a standstill where entities, although they are allowed to start the execution process, among them, they will agree in suspending rights temporarily for 3 or 6 months in order to negotiate a global restructuring with the company. So the steering committee in large corporations should be created as soon as possible. And we will tell you the percentages and the members of the steering committee. There's another concept, which is the company directors, company managers, direct responsibility, which is very important. Depending on this legislation, some countries, for instance, in Germany, if a CFO believes that insolvency will come within 3 months and there's no solution, his personal obligation is to tender the company. And if that doesn't happen, they may even go to jail. This is a powerful incentive. So company management will accelerate their process as soon as possible. This is not as clear in other countries such as Mexico. If there's fraud, if there's financial or accounting fraud, there may be an opportunity to file a complaint against management. But if restructuring has not been done, it will be very difficult. This depends on this legislation, but this is why the industry will accelerate or not its restructuring. Finally, there's another concept, the value destruction. The sooner we intervene in these processes and the declining profits, cash flow, or default, less value of the company will be destroyed and better opportunities to recover. The more we wait, the higher the value destruction for all parties. Nobody will benefit from these processes. And I believe that we should all clearly understand this concept under this type of situation. Next, Carlos, let's move on to symptoms and causes. Now that we must start to act upon management incentives, we must make sure that we're acting and we're addressing the cause. But the symptoms are always the first to appear. And that's when we should be alarmed, when there's a drop in sales, when there's a reduction in benefits. It's when it's hard to file for credits and creditors start to set pressure, creative accounting process are started. So out of these, the most harmful symptom that commonly unleashes a fall descent in the company is lack of liquidity and lack of access to new sources of credit. But perhaps we've seen this already because symptoms sometimes appear together and they just feed on among them. Let me talk now about an airline and its pre-COVID earnings, where it had recognized operative losses, claiming that they were not going to be able to recover in a strong way. They were below 10% revenues. They had losses throughout the different sectors, the domestic, South Atlantic, They were also losing in North America their traffic with Europe. They were losing quota in all the markets due to competition. And the board of directors had decided on network structuring and what airlines usually do, you know, removing charges here, checking the frequent flyer programs, checking what they would do with heavy maintenance, with hardening, with shared service centers. However, if we address the causes, we had to address the actual causes. We had only focused on the symptoms, and everybody was accepting that. Everybody was embracing that it was the right process, the right thing to do. But it was pre-COVID. When the sky fell down upon us, when the pandemic came, they understood that this solution was not going to work, that it was only symptom oriented. So what was happening? What is happening that although prices had been maintained, they were not able to compete against low cost airlines. They had removed chairs, aisles, and they had different schemes. They did not perceive that one of those issues was their cost structure, because their cost structure was higher than their competitors. Their cockpit had certain issues. Handling was also twice as their competitors in domestic flights. And we saw that the plan was useless. So we're preparing another program that's completely different, where financial entities have now come to understand that all plans they present should be rejected if an adjustment is not made to reduce the network's capabilities, and that it should happen as for the soft and medium transformations by reducing also in having a salary adjustment. So, of course, all these measures are not easy. They're not easier at all, and they are problematic. This is what we need to think of in defining the scope and the goals of the restructure. If you take a look at the next slide and you try to understand the importance of identifying a company's ultimate causes and to focus on the scope of the restructuring, if a fine restructuring should be made, or on the contrary, because it may imply a deep change in the company's structure. Let us think about office rental companies. They will have to restructure at the midterm, and we must also think about our time frame and if another outbreak is expected in the near future, if a recovery will come next year, this year, or if no recovery should be expected. And we must also focus on our stakeholders. Is the management team in alignment with the process? Will shareholders invest? Are they going to assist? We have to invest in the new business plan, and it must be realistic as well. It must be doable in time and form. And we should also contemplate something else. The management team, is it ready to implement the new business plan? Any business plan that is not believable will pose a huge obstacle at the time of restructuring. And finally, the new plans must be thoroughly followed up. because red lines will end up crossing, leading to extreme changes, but we must make sure that things are dealt with in due time and manner. And the key is realism, and it's a type of realism that should entail common agreement between lenders and debtors. Both must understand that this is a situation where both parties must be believable, capable, in order to preserve both the company's value as well as to protect the loans granted by financial entities. Any time a detour is sought for, the actual causes of the issues are not going to work. Sometimes they may buy you some time, but at the end of the day, you're really wasting valuable time that will only deteriorate the company value, the assets, the shares, and the debt if the actual causes are not addressed. This is our experience, and I'm sure you will share this perspective. As Carlos was saying, and I don't want to get you all mixed up, but in this phase, when we decided to go for a restructuring process and the declining profits and default part, the scope just mentioned by Carlos is absolutely necessary, and you have to do it that very moment, not at the end of the negotiation process. The financial entities have to determine the type of negotiation they want to have, the type of scope, and the type of expected results for the negotiation, in addition to how to follow through with a certain negotiation, because the negotiation is not an end by itself. Specialists tend to believe that they were magnificent in their negotiations, that it was the best business they could have made. But what's the result of that negotiation within 6 months, within 18 months? A negotiation that is properly followed up is better than no follow-up. That's the way it goes. And sometimes what ends up happening to us and to financial institutions is that they're all focused on their negotiation because it's demanding, but they fail to follow up, which is the most important part. Speaking of the negotiation and how it may be done, there are multiple formulas, but we decided to share an example of a major corporation with bilateral lends with bonds, multiple lenders. So personally, the most complex operation I ever was in had 75 banks from 7 different countries, because it had present in the UK, in Spain, in Poland, and they had something in Germany as well. So imagine how complex the process can be if there's no coordination. 75 banks speaking to the same manager. It's impossible. Something like that just won't work, because they wouldn't have time to eat, to sleep, only to talk to the banks without having time to carry out a negation process. In a pretty simplistic way, and I would like us to move on to the next slide, because this is where we summarize our different strategies. You have to focus on the bilateral negotiation that can be done. As you've seen, it is time consuming and it has many issues, such as one of those issues is not all financial entities have the same level of knowledge, or they don't have the same guarantees or the same ability to negotiate. Or there may be progress for a certain entity, but perhaps the slower one if it's in a weak condition, the whole process may change. Because as we know, legislations throughout the world establish that a certain percentage of financial entities accepting the agreement must exist In others, it's 65%, it's a qualified majority, and in others, it's up to 75% if consensus is not reached. Although two or three remaining entities may not have signed, you will find yourself in a situation where you did well for 3 months, and the last month, things just failed. A steering committee will solve many of our problems. First of all, in its creation, because entities with a high weight in the debtor's banking pool are required, so they already have great representation. Another objective is to create a communication channel with the minority institutions. They don't need to be part of the steering committee, but they should be informed, aligned, and convinced that this is the best structure. So they will also act in coordination with the entities. And another topic is sometimes avoid in restructuring processes, asymmetries. And this is sometimes a sum zero exercise because there's a certain number of guarantees and debts. And first come, first come, first served, leaving none till zero to none guarantees to the rest. With a steering committee, the problem may be minimized by trying to find a certain logic. Obviously, if somebody's starting point it was full secured and everybody's secured, the full secured will not give guarantees to the non-secured, but an important discussion on additional guarantees may exist throughout the company if it still had assets, if they had not been put as a guarantee, as to have a reasonable agreement for all the parties involved. I think that it could be taken into account for a steering committee. Finally, I'm going to move to the last part of the presentation, financing alternatives and analysis. In this section, we will discuss several basic strategies observed in the financing strategy. And I'm not going to talk about the accounting or fiscal treatment because it deserves a session on its own, but I do want to describe how each strategy may have a positive or negative impact on the provisions granted by the financial institutions. These strategies can be implemented mostly in an isolated way or a combined way as well. You could opt for refinancing the company after the pandemic and re-execute the different operations with the company's non-strategic areas. Sometimes the strategies may be a consequence of prior decisions by decision makings, and that's what we need to care for as pertains the different actors involved. First, this is what you can do. You can do nothing. If there's a need for refinancing, the financial institution does nothing. And this is valid. It may be two ways. The first is that it's not worth to invest in something like that. You should only invest when there's talent around if you want to recover the organization. And the other, which is more normal, you should to identify shareholders to try to make a bigger effort and provide more funds instead of having to go to the financial entities for provision services. What are the risks? The risks are controlled, and the fact that you're now in the hands of your manager and your shareholder, so there's a big risk there.
El apoyo de los shareholders.
And if you don't have the shareholder support, there let it fall, which is the worst thing that may happen. What is the impact on losses? Well, a company that has gone bankrupt or declared itself insolvent will have to deal with the losses for the company. And you know, this is just the first of all of the alternatives. Okay? There are more alternatives, aren't there, Igor? Well, the do-nothing alternative is sometimes the starting point of financial entities, and it can last a month, it can last a week, or a couple of them. It can, you know, you do it to understand how committed are the shareholders and what's going on with the debtor. Because the debtor's first request is, I have an issue, I want to go to the bank, hey, you know, a waiver, I need liquidity, I need an emergency loan for liquidity, and let me know what you suggest and how financial entities react. In the financial entities safety manual, the first question when somebody asks you for money is no. That's the first answer. That's it. And after that, you may conclude if the financial entity, if it has tried to assist the donor, and we end up finding out that there's no way that there will be better doing nothing, and it may lead to insolvency of the company. But it is generally an open statement. Do nothing, and that's will we will start with refinancing. I believe most entities, when you're speaking of restructure, the first thing that comes to mind is, I believe that a negotiation, it will start now, which implies checking if there are new guarantees or no guarantees. What's the validity? What's the term? And am I going to give them liquidity? Of course, depending on the company's needs as well. And there's another aspect we sometimes don't have, and you must tell the debtor, you know, this subject to your giving me a sensible plan. And this is realism and not magic realism, like what Carlos was saying when he talked about the scope. The plan is not believable. If it's not realistic, we may restructure it. But as follow-up comes, the sales that had a 50% drop in the recovery plan for 3 months has not worked, we'll have to open up a different restructuring process. You need to prevent that from happening as far as possible, because second and third processes are extremely complicated. You need to try to restructure once and do it great the first time around. Sometimes it's possible, sometimes it isn't, but it should be all entities' objective when you feel yourself like going through a restructuring process. And when there's liquidity, what are the risks for the financial entities? If I know that if I had to have 2 grand liquidity, my risk is increasing. And that good money versus bad money, does it make sense or doesn't it make sense? And it has to be a clear answer. Otherwise, a financial entity's credit committee will end up will not authorizing. This will, the questions about repayment must be answered. Otherwise, we're not doing the restructuring well. What should be avoided and what effects may it have on provisions? If we manage new guarantees, then we're doing just fine. But you have to be mindful about the new guarantees, because the legislation of certain companies have a blowback or retraction, which means that if fraudulent guarantees are extended and the bank, then the company, we have a company loss within a couple of months, the bank will know that fiction was created to grant guarantees to certain entities, and the judge may write or may cancel the guarantees. That's what you must avoid, as well as pretend to next extend restructuring. It's like, hey, I know you're not going to pay me, but I'm going to give this loan 2 years. I'm going to remove the provision and you still have a performing loan, which is dangerous, because at the end of the day, if we do not address the identified causes, the company situation will continue to deteriorate and the lack of guarantees will be even larger than if we had addressed the problem now. This is a pretty common situation. Another alternative that may be combined to the former are selective executions of certain loans. Because sometimes when you're talking about a company, you're not talking about just one legal entity, but there are fairly complicated schedules, or we have an outco, we have a holding company, we have a real estate company, another company with international subsidiaries. So we have to understand the perimeter of the business to be restructured, and the most important part, what is the viable perimeter of the business. If it's not viable, perhaps selectively you may cancel those loans by executing guarantees and refinancing the rest of the company perimeter. That decision should be made depending on the business plan and the company's status. So this is no panacea, because we may have a loan to value of 50%, which means that the execution and the loan is going to be foreclosed. But is this value the same valuation we had before the crisis? In the new environment, this is what the value is. It has gone down 50 to 60. The next question is, what's the cost of this execution? For a time, for lawyers, and what will happen with asset deterioration, like the classic example, mortgage. How can the asset damage, if this takes me 2 years in court and the asset is still in the hands of the debtor and they're not paying taxes, there's no insurance. So you have to bear that in mind as well. I'm going to skip chapter 11 and I'm going to talk about debt for asset swap and debt for equity swap, because it's key for securities foreclosure. One of the paths is legal execution, and the normal example is 2 years. There's a shortcut as well. We tell the debtor that it will end up in foreclosing, it will cost you money, it will cost me money, let's do something. Let's agree on swapping and debt for asset swap, okay? You give me your asset and I cancel your debt. It can be brought to the table, but we need to be careful because the financial entity will not report the car or the asset in the balance sheet. There are associated costs to those assets, and the provision will only be released when the asset is no longer part of the company's balance sheet or its subsidiaries. So only when sold to a third party and a true sale is done and a certain payment is done, we will be able to determine if the provision was enough or if it may be written off, provisioned, or accounted for as a loss. We need to bear that in mind, and it often demands financial institutions creating a specific asset management unit, or that they signing a service agreement to manage the asset while they will have the asset in their warehouse. And in the current situation, selling an asset may even take up to a year, 2-3 years, depending on the type of asset. The debt for equity swap implies swapping the debt for the equity and taking a hold of the company. And creditors take a hold of the company, and that's how other types of procedures can be done that you cannot do in a typical structure. You can appoint somebody, you can decide the sale of the company, facilitating control. Depending on the type of situation, that's how you can do it. Finally, chapter 11 of bankruptcy process is not a strategy per se, unless we clearly understand that by reinforcing the chapter 11 will be the way, and it is normally the consequence of the previously mentioned strategies. If we do nothing, we may end up in chapter 11. If the refinancing agreement failed, we can end up in chapter 11. If selective foreclosure of credits and securities is not done, then we will enter a chapter 11 or bankruptcy process. In these processes, from the financial entity's perspective, it is also very important to understand how they compare themselves to other financing sources. If you're doing well and it's good for you to execute individually, and what the company is doing goes to chapter 11, but your guarantees are still valid, then you'll be okay. But if you're insecure or you're subordinate, if you have a junior loan, you may end up finding yourself in a complicated situation, because the characteristics of the bankruptcy process may be 60, 70, 80, 90%, and you may end up losing your whole loan because there's no money in the companies, and senior officials may absorb that value. At large, these are the strategies and notions within a restructuring process. As we said initially, they do not happen in isolation. There may be combinations of different options. And in the temporary plan with refinancing, within a year, we end up finding ourselves with an execution process, debt for equity swap, and it may end up turning into chapter 11. There's nothing written about these processes. It's only about performing and ad hoc analysis in each of the cases and to establish the best alternative. This is the end of our presentation. Thank you, Carlos. Thank you, Igor. Thank you for such fabulous recommendations, and to our participants, thank you as well. We will have you here. We invite you all for September 3. Thank you very much.